Hello, this is Lindsay Downs with WCET, welcoming you to something completely different, the very first and currently only episode of the new WCET Frontiers podcast. Yes, you heard me right. This is a podcast for you to actually hear the WCET team, our featured guest hosts, and our interviewees talk about solutions and innovations in the practice and policy of digital learning and higher education. In this, our first episode, our host discusses building community in digital learning formats. I'll let her introduce herself and her outstanding guests. And hey, if you like this format of hearing from us, drop us a note and let us know at wcetinfo@witchy.edu. For now, here is the very first episode of the WCET Frontiers Pod. Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the WCET Frontiers Pod. I am your host, Dr. Elaine Villanueva-Bernal, STEM Digital Learning Strategist for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for WCET, and a full-time lecturer at California State University, Long Beach. For today's episode, we're exploring how to build community in different digital learning formats. And I have here two of my most awesome colleagues from Cal State Long Beach, Go Beach. We have Dr. Beth Mankey, Interim Assistant Vice President for High Impact Practices, and Dr. Brian Trimble, Assistant Professor of Art Education in our School of Art. And we're going to be talking about Students Respond to the COVID-19 Crisis, a Photo Voice Project, where students reflected upon and documented their experiences through photographs and narratives. Folks, welcome. So first off, if you can introduce yourselves and talk about some of the work you do at Cal State Long Beach.
Well, first of all, thanks, Elaine, for inviting us. My name is Beth Mankey, and you know, I've been on campus now, this is my 20th year. And so I started as a professor in the Department of Human Development, teaching everything from internships to statistics. And then I spent 4 years serving as the associate dean in the College of Liberal Arts, where I launched several student success initiatives. And then right now I'm currently serving as the interim vice president for high impact practices. So a lot of my work is really focused on how do we meet students where they're at to provide these transformative learning experiences, whether that's internships, service learning, study abroad, research with a faculty member. So the work that Brian and I have done on Photo Voice is so in line with my approach and focus on really thinking about how our students are navigating their own trajectories here on campus. What are we doing as a campus to meet them where we're at? How do we question our own practices to ensure that we're not creating barriers for our student success?
And I am Brian Trimble. I am an assistant professor in art education. I actually have a fairly long history on the campus as well. Beth and I started working together when I was the curator of education at the University Art Museum, now the Clefield Contemporary Art Museum. And I started there in 2005. Actually, shortly thereafter, I started working with Beth in terms of program evaluation, and then starting to look at these type of programs to see how the museum was connecting with students on campus. Mm-hmm. And in 2014, I believe, is when we did our first Photo Voice project. During that time, I finished my doctorate and eventually was hired in a tenure track position in the School of Art. And now I'm the program head for art education.
Wow, thank you so much for that. So with the Photo Voice, so tell us about that project.
Well, I'll start and then I'll let Brian take over. Actually, it was, you know, fascinating. Brian had reached out to me shortly after COVID hit, and he had been using Photo Voice in one of his classes. And we began to talk about, you know, was this a moment in history when we really needed to capture students' voices and capture student voices in ways that helped illuminate how our campus was navigating crises for students, whether it be COVID or something else. And so, you know, we were concerned that as a campus, we were making lots of decisions that affected students. You know, were we asking students to quarantine? Were we going to be offering mm-hmm. classes? How are we going to be helping students meet their basic needs? And we were making these decisions in some ways in a vacuum, in ways that did not involve students. And so we were super concerned that we wanted to give students voice, and how could we do that in ways that were meaningful without students on campus? And so there began, you know, this project. I think at the beginning, we didn't really know what we were going to get and would we be able to do this? Would any student be willing to actually do this in the context of what was a chaotic time period over the course of more than 12 months when we were collecting data. But, you know, we had almost or well over 900 students submit photos and narratives to our project, really with the cooperation and collaboration of faculty and staff across the campus. So they were also incredibly instrumental in helping us reach students and give students the opportunity to reflect and to tell their stories.
Yeah, and I think personally for my, you know, for my chemistry 100 class, you know, it was really an opportunity for students to kind of reflect and digest what's happening, especially at the moment, because I mean, we were all kind of freaking out, like, oh my gosh, like, when are we going to see each other again? You know, and how do we transition and how do we pivot? So, you know, this was, you know, certainly a great platform for students to just voice their concerns or whatever they're going through.
We started to realize that this project kind of went beyond just providing students an opportunity to have a voice about what was happening. I mean, when you really think about it, what we were doing was actually providing an opportunity for students to kind of stop and assess their own positionality about what was happening around them. It became this opportunity for reflection as well. So looking at what was happening in their own lives, how they were responding to what was happening around them that they may or may not have had control over. And we saw a lot of that come through in the responses from students.
Yeah, and I certainly hear that. I mean, a lot of my students and a lot of my colleague students as well, I mean, everybody works, takes, you know, 14, 15 units, right? So yeah, this was certainly an opportunity to just sort of pause and take stock and see where you are. So thank you for that.
Well, and I was just going to say, I think the other thing that it helps students do too, and this reminded me when Brian was talking, is that I think a lot of times our students think that they're the only ones who are experiencing things in a certain way. So if you're not sharing and you don't have a platform to share what's going on or articulate, it's very easy to think, am I the only one? Am I the only one who's struggling? Particularly when you hear things like, hey, we're all in this together. Well, the truth is we're all in the same storm. We're not all in the same boat. And so I think one of the things that we were committed to was sharing the information that we were collecting. And so, you know, with the generous collaboration of the Kleefeld Art Museum on campus, you know, they provided gallery space, virtual gallery space on their website where we could post students' entries, their narratives, their photographs. And so other students could see, wow, I'm not the only one who's experiencing anxiety and stress. Oh, wait, I'm not the only one who lost my job and struggling to make ends meet. And so I think that that was also a very critical key component of what we were doing.
I think both of us viewed this as working within our community to share what was happening in our community, that we were connecting with other faculty. We were working with administrators. Beth was sharing. We weren't just sharing with the Kleefeld. She was actually sharing with the provost and the president on a weekly basis sometimes about some of the responses that were coming in. And to be able to have the Kleefeld then give us a larger format to share multiple images and narratives, I think really helped us view this as a way to see our students as part of this community and for them to see it too, this kind of CSULB broader community and what was happening with COVID.
It sounds like a monumental task, especially with 900 submissions from all students with different backgrounds, you know, on campus. How did you navigate and analyze all those submissions, and what were some themes and trends that emerged from those submissions?
Yeah, such a great, great question. I mean, I think collecting them is one thing, sorting through them is another.
In any research project, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, and I think true to the qualitative nature of PhotoVoice, you know, I think central to our efforts, first of all, was a team. And mm-hmm. so we had a really great team of two graduate students and an undergraduate who really helped us code. And so, first of all, we'd like to recognize that, you know, we really grounded our efforts in, you know, some theoretical foundations that are consistent with the ways in which we view our students. So, you know, using YOSO's community cultural wealth model, for those who are familiar with it, it really moves away from deficit thinking about our students and really thinking about what assets and strengths do they bring to higher education. So, you know, some familial capital, resistance capital, things of that nature. And we really grounded our coding in that theoretical foundation. And, you know, really spent several months combing through using an iterative approach to develop themes that could then be used in combination, you know, with some software to actually go through and collect, like, you know, looking at what percentage of students' narratives touched on different themes. So I can give you an example. So, for example, you know, one of the most robust themes, one that is, I think, denoted by, you know, well over 80% of our students are issues surrounding mental health.
Yeah.
So for example, we know that our students, you know, grappled with lots of mental health issues. And, you know, to me, the beauty of the narrative is so much more powerful than me simply saying that. So when I say, oh, 80% of our students, you know, talked about or made reference to something mental health related, it's very different than reading a narrative. And so, like, I'm going to give you an example of a narrative. So we had a student submit a photograph, actually a pretty powerful, daunting photograph, one that every time I look at makes me a little nervous, because the student is actually sitting what looks like on a roof with her legs sort of dangling over the edge. And her narrative reads, "I think this photo perfectly captures my state of mind as the repercussions of COVID-19 progress. Being someone who suffers from severe generalized anxiety disorder and PTSD, I'm always working toward stability. In these uncertain times," in quotes, "has been a plague to my mental health. I used to describe taking control of my anxiety as shedding a mask, to which I now wear hours on end. I've never felt so helpless, watching all achievements in my life slip away from me, graduation, internships, opportunities, and even friendships. If the ledge is sanity, my legs are dangling." And, you know, for me, that kind of narrative tells the story so much better in a student's voice, in their own words, than me simply summarizing and saying, hey, a lot of our students, you know, we're addressing mental health issues. So that was certainly one of the very significant themes. One of the things I should note that I think neither one of us had anticipated was the fact that themes changed over time and evolved over time.
Absolutely.
So, you know, early on, we had lots of entries that really talked about anxiety, like not knowing, like, what is this? You know, maybe even addressed miscommunications because people didn't know what things were, you know. And then as time went on, we began to see more mental health, anxiety sorts of themes. And then, you know, COVID is placed in a larger historical context. You know, when we hit May and June, we start to see the intersection of COVID and Black Lives Matter emerge within our students' photos and narratives. And then interestingly, we start to see almost, not that things become commonplace, but there's, you know, less discussion about the anxiety of what is, and maybe even the commonplace of wearing masks, things of that nature. And then I think a real emergence of loss, loss of people, loss of rituals, you know, loss of freedom and autonomy, you know, loss of the normalcy of your schedule. And so we see that evolution almost charted like on a timeline.
Right. Yeah. It's really powerful when you see it actually on the timeline, looking at it. One of the other really big themes for us was familial capital that Beth mentioned. And one of my favorites is, it's a black and white photograph. And it is a scene in the front yard of a house. And you see a young girl sitting on a chair about 10 feet away in front of her grandparents sitting in chairs.
Yeah.
They're all wearing masks. The narrative says, this is my six-year-old sister visiting her grandparents during the pandemic. She can't recall the last time she hugged or kissed them. Before school ended, her grandpa would pick her up and drive to McDonald's to pick up breakfast. They would order one sausage McMuffin. She would eat the sausage and her grandpa would eat the English muffin. This was their bonding time. Now, her visits to her grandparents' house are not the same. She is cautious about her distance and worries she might get them sick. So close and yet so far.
God, that's so powerful. And I think the narratives that you both just shared just now, and then putting that in context of communal, you know, community cultural wealth, it's so important because often, we don't see what our students are already bringing into our classrooms. We don't know the lives that they're currently living, you know, as they navigate, you know, our campus and our classrooms. So I'm really glad that, you know, that was something that you noticed and observed in your findings. So I'm curious, so a little bit more about community cultural wealth. What were also some other sources of capital within this framework that you thought, you know, students were tapping into?
Well, there was aspirational capital, which for me was a really important one, because I think with aspirational capital, you really got to see the resilience of our students in their responses.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that exactly that, you know, the aspirational capital that many of them continue to hold on to these hopes and dreams. You know, this idea of thinking about the future and being able to see what might be in the future. And I would say that's the same thing when I'm thinking about navigational capital, you know, this ability to navigate around barriers. Because I think for many of our students, COVID isn't the first barrier they've had to navigate around. Mm-hmm. Many of our students are dealing with, you know, systemic structural racism on a day-to-day basis, you know, and so and listening through their voices and the narratives. I'm looking at a picture right now of a really great, in fact, beautiful photo of one of our students who is a bus driver, a public transit bus operator. And he writes about being on the front line since day one. And what's fascinating is he really talks about what it was like when they didn't have personal protective equipment in the beginning, and, you know, and talking about policies and barriers put in place to protect, you know, as best as can permit. And then he writes, but I do feel slighted that sheltering in place and finding refuge at home was never really an option for me. This pandemic hasn't been very kind to the working class. And so lots of our students talking about that, talking about how are they navigating around, how might some of the protections put in place actually, you know, were not available to them because they still had to go out and make ends meet for their families. So they're working, restaurants, or they're working frontline kinds of jobs, and that, how do they navigate that?
And then Brian, was there anything that you'd like to add to that?
No, I think Beth really summed it up. But in terms of, if we go back to some of the other things that we're talking about in terms of YOSO's community cultural wealth model, I think community capital was a big one as well. You know, and that reliance on your community really showed through in terms of where people look for strength.
I was just thinking, you know, Elaine, in that sort of thinking about aspirational capital, going back, I was trying to think if I had an example, and I have one that I think also dovetails with this idea that although clearly the COVID and the pandemic has had many negative repercussions for our students, is that our students were actually able, in terms of saying aspirational capital and navigational capital, to find what I might call pockets of joy within the pandemic. And, you know, we had a student who submitted this beautiful photograph of these plants that she's propagating to plant again. And there's some really great shadows of the plants. And she writes, "When we first started talking about COVID-19 earlier this year, I didn't know how my life was going to be affected. In a matter of weeks, CSU will be halted in-person classes, and I had lost my job. As the world was changing, so was I. Quarantine has allowed me to dig deep internally, discover new qualities about myself, and helped me clear out negative things that were taking up space in my life. I've begun to propagate plants, decided to be more sustainable, took procrastination out of my vocabulary, and in my free time, I enjoy growing in the shadows." And so for me, that's such a powerful message that our students, even in the context of sorrow and pain and loss and anxiety and, you know, mental health issues, many of them are finding these islands of respite. They're finding ways in which to navigate. And for some of them, it's about changing their perspective on what's happening. And so I found that, for me, incredibly powerful.
Right. And to add to that, I mean, we were able to look at the valence of responses to see if there were students were writing in a negative or positive tone in the word choices. And they actually wrote in a more positive tone at a higher rate than they did in a negative tone. And I think this shows up in aspirational capital when we look at that. There's another one that I like a lot. And it shows a young woman doing a yoga pose in her living room. And the narrative says, "It has been a difficult time emotionally and mentally. I've lost my job and had to move 90 miles back to my hometown. My goals suddenly seemed further away. However, I didn't let fear scare me. I continued to do the activities I loved from the safety of my home. The adjustments weren't easy, but it kept me sane. Activities such as yoga have improved my mentality by seeing situations from a positive perspective. The COVID-19 pandemic has only just started, but it will not stop me from chasing my dreams. I will continue to set goals, stay active, and meditate." So, of course, at the beginning of this, she's really addressing the difficulties of how the pandemic has affected her life. And yet she ends with this kind of, future looking aspirational quote that I think is fantastic.
Yeah. And I love hearing about your experiences and looking and analyzing these narratives so far. It's just really seeing the train of thought that students have. Like, it's not just they're going through this or going through that. You can really see, like, okay, like, I am, you know, looking at my context right now, and here's how I'm adapting, and here's what I'm looking forward to. And it's a wonderful story to tell and, you know, build community around. A lot of things about changes and how students adapt, and a little bit about trends of what's changed. How long did Photo Voice run for, and what were some other things that you noticed throughout the duration of the project?
Now, we collected data for just about just shy of a year. So beginning when the pandemic started all the way through January of this year. So, you know, about 10 to 11 months, we collected photos and narratives from students. I guess in terms of one of the other things that I saw that I really wanted to share was that, you know, we talk a lot about what Photo Voice does for students in terms of reflecting and articulating. But I think it's important to also recognize, and in a minute here, I'm hoping Brian will share maybe a little bit about an email he got from a student. But one of the things that I think I wanted to comment on was what Photo Voice did for faculty. And I can speak directly to an email that we got from a faculty member who reached out to us. Her class did Photo Voice. And at the end of the semester, you know, she wanted to see some of their responses because they didn't share them necessarily in class before they submitted them. And so, you know, we stripped all identity from those narratives and photos. and we shared them with the instructor, and we got a really poignant response from her, which was that she learned so much about her students. She talked about the fact that, you know, initially she was really disappointed in some ways in her students' performance that semester, but that by seeing their photos and their narratives, it put their performance in context. You know, she talked about the fact that, wow, if they were really, you know, experiencing these things, that it really made sense why they were struggling with some of the things that she was asking them to do, and that it really changed her perspective and changed the way in which she was going to approach her next semester of students, and that, you know, figuring out ways to lead with empathy, to meet her students where they're at, so that she could create space for them to share those experiences, and that she didn't have to wait until afterwards, meaning knowing full well that this wasn't just business as usual, but yet on virtual. It's that having to really approach the situation, as I said, from a space of empathy, and understanding that what was happening for many of our students.
Well, and I think we all understood the situation we were in intellectually at some level, but it really did take seeing the images and reading what the students were actually experiencing to understand at the level that she needed to understand this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, when we got word that we were going to, you know, be teaching and learning remotely, and as the pandemic, you know, started and continued and still going on today, there was certainly a feeling of disconnectedness that I was feeling. And then in being able to see what my students wrote and, you know, or just to see what students wrote in general, it provided that sense of like, oh, like, I see what's happening, you know, like I'm not totally disconnected from what's happening, and good or bad, it was just really nice to see that for the most part, students were, you know, we're still living their life the way they needed to, you know, and that was really powerful to see.
Right.
Well, and I think too, kind of to that, Elaine, it's like not hearing about mental health issues or economic issues or housing issues. I mean, we had lots of stories about students crammed into small spaces and trying to find places to study. And I think recognizing through our photos and narratives that simply because we don't hear about them from our students doesn't mean it's not happening. And I think that was really important. And, you know, for me, every time we got a new batch of photos and narratives, and it was just incredibly humbling. Like, I was always struck by the degree to which our students were willing to be vulnerable. I mean, many of these photos and narratives are, you know, best described as raw, you know, that it's just, you know, I've seen many people brought to tears. You know, the responses I've gotten from, you know, the provost and the president at the time of just being overwhelmed by what our students are going through. And, you know, for me, I think that was so important, you know, as we go about our daily lives as faculty, as administrators, and we're making decisions, it's so important to have at the forefront to remember that this is what our students are navigating, and that not all our students are the same. Because, you know, I think on the flip side, you know, we saw some really interesting instances of privilege. And I think that's the other piece, is recognizing we don't have a monolithic student. One size fits all. They're all the same. We have, you know, a subsample of students who, you know, I'm looking at one entry right now, and it's a picture of food that they prepared during pandemic versus, say, pre-pandemic. It's a really interesting split screen. And, you know, at the end of this narrative, the student talks about how everyone's lives have been affected by COVID-19. Yet I am privileged to be able to say it has only touched my dinner. And so this student recognizes that, you know, he or she did not lose their job, their family's jobs are well intact, they have a roof over their head. And so effectively, the only thing that has changed for them is what they're cooking for dinner and their access to, say, fruits and vegetables at the farmer's market or something. That's a very different story than the student who says, I had to move home and cram all of my belongings onto two racks in a garage because I can't afford to support myself anymore. And I'm really embarrassed about it. Those are so different experiences, right. And yet both are true about our students.
Yeah, and that's such an important point, because that's something that we still need to consider right now. Like there are some of us that are, you know, privileged to, you know, work from home and still be able to manage transitions, especially as kids go back to school or, you know, friends and family go back to school, right? And it can be so pretty stark sometimes. Overall, how did the, you know, issue of privilege show up in these submissions?
It actually showed up quite a bit. What I found fascinating, like the piece that Beth just talked about, that it did seem like several of the responses of students with privilege actually understood that they had privilege. Mm-hmm. And so that was really interesting to me.
Well, and I think too, I think a lot of our students with privilege talked about how they've spent their time. And so you could see it sometimes in the very access to things. Like I'm looking at one right now, which is a pile of knitted items. And the student writes, "The finished pile, 2 sweaters, 3 tanks, 2 hats. I knit to keep the anxiety down." And so although they go on to talk about the anxiety attached to assignments being due and the inability to focus on reading, it's quite clear that their struggle is about the isolation piece, not about, I can't afford food for my family. Everybody's lost their jobs or things mm-hmm. of that nature. So you can see it enter in those sorts of spaces. Or students who say, you know, I'm capitalizing on the opportunity to spend time with my parents, you know, because we're all working from home type of thing. And, you know, that's a very different situation than the student who writes about sharing a 1-bedroom apartment with 5 people and a dog, and that she sleeps in the living room, eats in the living room, goes to school in the living room, and everyone else is in the living room, you know? And so, you know, she says, "I have no privacy. I am tired." And again, a very different reality. And so in a way, you know, you can see the differences in access to resources, the differences maybe even in social class. But I think, as Brian pointed out, is that I think for maybe some of our students with privilege, it's been an opportunity for them to be self-reflective and to understand, as he mentioned before, their mm-hmm. own positionality. And so if anything in that has come out of it is maybe an appreciation and understanding of their position and maybe of their own responsibility to think about how they're contributing to make things better, or at least making room for others who have different experiences than their own.
And I think that self-reflection and being vulnerable, and then that self-awareness that comes out of recognizing what is happening around you, it's super important, especially since students have been, you know, so busy. We're also busy, right? And to be able to just sort of pause and take this opportunity to, hey, what is happening right now and how can we adapt to it?
The other thing that we've been able to do is we've been able to merge our data with institutional data. We can actually look at demographics of student responses. And so one of the things that we've been able to see with this, for example, with mental health issues, is that overall, what is it, 39%, Beth, in terms of our students responded with something about mental health. But when we break it down through demographics, we can see that our Pell eligible students or students that are low income are responding about mental health issues at a higher rate. And so that gives us really important data that we can then go back to the university and say, so in the future, we can say, hey, so these students need more assistance. We need to figure out a way to serve these students better in these times. That's really important data that we're getting out of this study.
Yeah, it's super important, because I think often too, especially when it comes to advising decisions or, you know, curricular pathways, I think, at least from my experience, it seems like a lot is being hedged on the numbers and not necessarily what are the stories and narratives of what's really happening. Like what are students, like literally students, you know, current realities as far as what they're going through. So last question. We've heard, you know, we've talked a lot about student experiences and what, you know, faculty thought about the project and what they learned from it. Also what our, you know, administration has learned from, you know, this project. But what were some of your biggest personal takeaways from this work?
I think for me, you know, maybe one of them has to do with students' need for spaces to be vulnerable and the ability to create safe space. So like I said, I was really shocked by the degree of vulnerability in many of these photos and narratives. And think about it. These are students who are submitting a photo and narrative to a project of people they don't know. Mm-hmm. And yet they were willing to bring to the situation some real raw emotion, the degree to which our students are reflective and that are in fact able to articulate these profound emotions, experiences, et cetera. And for me, that's a takeaway in that maybe a reminder to not underestimate our students' ability to see the big picture, to really value and understand that student voice is so important. You know, we do a lot, and I'm involved in a lot of endeavors on campus using institutionalized data, data that's collected about students. And I think for me, the profound learning piece is that data about students is not the same as data from students.
And that's powerful.
Yeah, having to create the space where they have authentic voice is so important. I learned so much about students just from these photos and narratives. For me as an educator, thinking about being in the classroom, how do I replicate that? How do I replicate the ability to create safe space for students to articulate at this level? Because I just have to believe that if they're doing it in this space, they would love to do it in the space of a classroom where they have a more meaningful connection with their professor. And so that if they need to say to their professor, hey, if the ledge is sanity, my legs are dangling, like what's the analogous to being able to communicate that to a professor to say, I'm so anxious about my situation. I can't focus on this test. That's the takeaway for me is it's what I learned and then the challenge that comes with it. It's like, I feel like I'm challenged to think about how do we replicate this so that this isn't the only space for students to articulate these experiences.
I'm going to echo some of what Beth said, and she's actually used that phrase a lot even before this study, that data about students is not the same as data from students. But this project really brings that home for me. You know, you really see that in this project. We would have never gotten to these major themes if we were just looking at data about students. We got to hear their voices. We got to hear them tell us about their experiences, about their families, about losing jobs, and about their resiliency. And for me, that was the other thing that really came out of this study, is to see the resiliency of our students, that in the face of this worldwide pandemic that's affecting all of us, and some of them at really devastating levels, that they have this resiliency. They have this ability to still look to the future. So for me, that was one of the biggest takeaways from the whole study.
With that, I just want to thank you both for, you know, featuring your work and discussing how is it that we can have a platform to provide students, you know, for you know, to share their voice, just to share what they're going through. And I really thought it was important as far as what you both mentioned towards the end, that data about students is totally different from data, you know, from students. So that's really, really powerful.